The Startup to Scale Up Game Plan is brought to you by Alpina Search, Europe's premier talent search firm, dedicated to helping technology startups and scale-ups recruit high-impact executives. Now over to your host, Gary Riemann.
I'm delighted to welcome Barry Hadfield to this week's episode. Barry's the founder and CEO at Mindset.ai. Now, Mindset is a SaaS venture who make every piece of content easily accessible with AI, solving the challenge of scattered information and time-consuming searches with their unique combination of generative AI and advanced knowledge graphs. And we'll find out a bit more about what we mean by advanced knowledge graphs later on. Barry's actually a serial entrepreneur. He's founded a handful of companies, employed thousands of people globally, and launched several products that went on to be market leaders in their niche. So Barry, a very warm welcome to this week's episode of the Startup Scale Up Game Plan.
Well, good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
Just to kick things off, Barry, you're on, I believe, your fifth startup scale-up journey. Why did the young Barry Hadfield decide he wanted to become an entrepreneur?
That's a great question. I think because I didn't want to have a job, basically. So I think it's as simple as that. I think I got my first job in my very early 20s when I first got to the UK. And they fired me after a year. And I thought to myself, well, I'm not doing that again. I don't want to be in a situation where people can't fire me. Literally, that was the thought process. I thought, this is, in order to be safer in my life, I need to have more control over what I'm doing and the things I'm doing. And I thought I could either work for other people and be their decision-making process, or I could work for myself and be my decision-making process. So it was as simple as that, really. And every job I've ever had since then, I've created in one form or another. So I think that kind of belief system became embedded in me and just became the way that I thought. And now, obviously, it's become a lot more sophisticated since then, because that was a little while back. So I think about things quite differently now. I think about the creation of companies and the ecosystem of people involved in that. And I found that as exciting as the technology and actually what we're doing. So it's no longer just about me. It's about the community of people that goes with that. But that was the original inspiration. I actually tell that story quite often to people.
And how did those early experiences influence your values and the culture that you've tried to create in each of your businesses?
That's a deep question, because I think I've become a lot more aware of culture as I've got older. So initially, I think I was just this kind of megalomaniac where I believed that everything centered around me and whatever I said went, and people's job was just to do my bidding. I honestly believe in my early days, that was my belief system. And it took a while for me to realize that in fact, was not the case. So, and actually probably quite late in life when I had the huge advantage of having a really, really fantastic business coach who worked very closely with me, who would kind of follow me around and spend time with me. And I'd have a conversation with someone and then he'd take me aside and he'd think, what did you hear in that conversation? Or what did you really think actually went on? And I realized very, very quickly that I actually was, disjointed from reality. So that led me to kind of understand my position and what I'm doing and this notion of culture, being separate to yourself. So culture being a collection of people. And I think I said to you when we spoke earlier, for me, culture is one of the most important things. So it's not something you can control either. It's something that evolves. So culture is the collection of the common beliefs of the people who are inside your business. And I guess the practices and the processes that you inhibit, and people look to you for it. So you have to be an example of it. You have to exemplify it yourself. I think it's incredibly important. I think it's probably the most important thing.
You mentioned the business coach. So is he or she still supporting you today, or is that more in the past?
Well, I'd say he's a very good friend now. So I think we've moved on. It's been a more than a 10-year relationship so far. So I still, if I have any issue, I'll call him straight up. His name is Tim, and speak it through. And I think also, and he may or may not hear this, but I think the relationship goes both ways now these days. I help him with aspects of challenges that he has. But I think that the ability to speak to someone in that type of forum, I think, is very powerful and important, because the other people in your lives all have one form or another of agenda with you. So be your partner, be the people you're working with, be the, you know, your customers, whoever it might be. So having this neutral relationship where it's really focused on you and your betterment, making you a better leader or whatever they're doing, I actually think everybody in this world could really benefit from that. I know for me it was transformational. So it really allowed me to see into myself in a way that I had not been able to before then.
I've had quite a few guests on the podcast who have referenced strong mentors and coaches.
Yes.
Who've helped them clear their heads, think more creatively, deal with stress or strategic issues or cultural issues. So yeah, it can be valuable for almost every entrepreneur to have someone.
I used to speak about mentors and I used to have lots of mentors, but in truth, I was using my mentors as a mechanism to get what I needed from them. They would think they're mentoring me, but in truth, I was just trying to get something from them in one way or another. And I do apologize to all my previous mentors that might get this. But that really was the case. I wasn't really looking to learn. I was looking to gain. So when the relationship was clearly established as a paid business coach, whether there was a very definitive relationship, I think that's when I truly got benefit, because a conversation of a mentor is not going to be as confrontational as one of a coach who says, you know, what on earth are you doing? That's the most ridiculous conversation I've ever heard. How can you, you know, believe that? And really seriously confront you in a way that I think you just walk away from a mentor, what I would have done.
So a lot more authenticity with this coach. How did you first come across him? Were you introduced to him? Did you bump into him at a networking event? How did that come about?
No, he was my punishment. So he was my punishment for bad behavior inside the business. Barry, being a megalomaniac and believing that the world centered around him, was playing out. And management at the time, people around me made it a condition upon continuing. So I thought, oh, well, this is not going to work, but I'll play along with it and we'll see how it goes. And this incredibly clever, amazing man arrived called Tim Taylor and was transformational. So I guess I got very lucky. I think had it been someone else, not as clever as Tim, I could have manipulated them and I could have run circles around them, but not with Tim. That wasn't possible. So this is someone who'd been a business leader in his own right, who is now this very focused coach, and I think he broke through.
And let's come up to date or up to more contemporary times. What was the spark behind the creation of Mindset.ai? Were there any specific market gaps that you identified and aimed to address?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I'll say it came from an innovation perspective versus a customer need perspective. Different companies come from different places, but this one came from innovation. So the innovation that we were interested in, upon exit of my previous business, thought to myself, what was the toughest problem that we faced? And wouldn't it be interesting looking at that problem? Why couldn't we solve it? And what could we build there? So the toughest problem we faced actually was driving the numbers of engagement and retention on a SaaS platform. So engagement and retention, so people arriving on your platform, doing what you want them to do, and then staying, drives directly to the business metrics of CAC to LTV, so your cost of acquisition to your lifetime value of the customer. And lifetime value of a customer is the most important metric in a company. I think many, many people think that ARR is, but that's very short-termist. Actually, LTV is the most important metric. And LTV means, because one customer, you're going to spend a bit of money acquiring them, but they're going to stay for a very long time. So they have enormous cumulative value to you in many ways. So that comes all the way down to kind of, are they getting value and are they staying on a daily basis and using a product? And a huge amount of effort goes into that. And the tools at your disposal, if you're doing it really, really well, are maybe A/B testing or multivariate testing. So you're testing version one versus against version two of a new feature or of a way of describing something or whatever it might be. And we did a lot of that at my previous company. We had a big team of people and every single day we'd have a meeting and we'd discuss the last data of the last 24 hours. But we kind of realized that, well, I realized afterwards maybe, that what was happening was we were driving to the most average version of our software because we were choosing the A and B test. And if one wanted 51% of people wanted A and 49% wanted B, Well, you'd throw away the 49% of the people, you go with the 51% of people. So the more you did that, the more average your software would become. And actually what the world wanted was to be treated like a human being, like a person. So people want the opposite. People wanted to be treated individually, but software is going in the direction to treat everyone in an average way. So we thought, could we build a platform that's job was to try and find the best path for the specific user? So in a way, kind of leave your A-B test running all the time and then come up with all sorts of different routes that people might navigate your platform, whatever your platform is doing. So that's where we started. Once we'd kind of proven that we could make that work, we actually built the initial kind of gym application, and then COVID came along. So we pivoted that quite quickly into something else. And I actually worked with a number of different training organizations and coaching organizations and people who had a desire really to scale their businesses. So to take what they've done, which was quite non-scalable because it involved their own time, to see if we could kind of translate that across into a way to let a software platform do so. And that's what we've been doing at Mindset. And then the best thing in the world happened. So the best thing in the world happened is this year, OpenAI launched ChatGPT. And for someone like me, who's been involved in the enterprise content management space for 35 years, I was just shocked and blown away and delighted by generative AI, which is something I never thought I'd see in my lifetime. I knew it would come. You know, I knew it would come because I've seen Star Trek and people speak to computers and they speak back to them. So that was perfectly logical that that was going to be the case. But I didn't think I'd see it in my lifetime. And even now, if you go back and watch Star Trek, it actually looks ridiculous in terms of actually what's capable. It looks like they didn't fully grasp what was actually going to be capable. So this year has been all about that. And I joke often, but I really do mean this, that if you meet a technologist this year, if they don't look tired, they're not doing their job. Because we've suddenly got this amazing new capability of generative AI, which I think is reinventing every single computer interface. So we've very much taken that and applied that to our original principle about how do we build a hyper-personalized system or platform that uses generative AI as well to its full extent.
Two questions about what you just shared with me. Firstly, were you already using some form of generative AI that you developed internally before ChatGPT came onto the scene? And number two, this focus on LTV as the key metric, how big a challenge is it for you to educate the market so that they realize that LTV is more important than ARR?
So firstly, no, we were not using any form of generative AI. So we were using machine learning. There's a lot of that. So machine learning is throwing lots of examples at an algorithm, saying to an algorithm what outcome you're looking for, and then throwing lots of data at it, and then getting some information from it. So that's one technology. It's an interesting technology. It requires a lot of data, and then it starts giving you some outcomes. Generative AI is completely different. I see generative AI being like a database, but unlike anyone that we've had before. It's a non-precise one where you have absolutely no idea what you're going to get out. You put something in, and something will come out, and hopefully that thing will be good. And sometimes it's really good, and sometimes it's really not, much like a person. So if you ask them something, you get a good answer or you get a really bad answer, maybe from the same person. That's what that is. So we hadn't used any form of it before. And I think only it's taken this year and vast hundreds, thousands of hours of work to actually understand the layers that need to be put on top of that to build a proper business application that can use this form of database technology underneath it. That's the answer to the first question. To the second question, the LTV one is much more tricky because people are driven by ARR and MRR, really. So you need to take quite a long-term view of the valuation of a company to do that. And most decision-making in the world is quite short-termist. So we think a lot about ARR, we think about MRR. Actually, oddly, I think we think more about ARR because ARR is just a promise. You know, MRR is a real measure. This is probably the most important kind of lead indicator that you've got kind of going through. But LTV is the final, the real valuation.
And let's talk about the future. In what ways do you see Mindset.ai shaping the future of AI and its applications? Are there any industries or sectors where you're anticipating significant impact and transformation?
Another great question, actually. So I think that I'll take it outside of our context and I'll bring it back into our own context. I think every single interface with every single piece of software is up for grabs right now in terms of how it's going to change. And that's been driven by human expectation. So I think as soon as we can easily talk to our washing machine and tell it that you wanted to sort out your red jumper that's got a stain on it, and it says, no problem, give it to me, put it in, and it'll come out clean. As soon as you've got a washing machine like that, you're going to expect that of every other appliance that you've got and every system. So there's going to be no more complicated pushing buttons trying to make something happen and being irritated with your car or whatever it might be. So I think every single interface is going to change. I think every single software package is going to change. You know, you think about the laboriousness of so much of what we do. You know, simple things. Booking meetings with people is really annoying at the moment, even though you can send them a calendar link and, you know, you never get it right, and it's always annoying. So even really, really basic things like that are up for grabs in terms of how they're going to be eventually. Because what I want to say is book a meeting with Sam, please. Speak to Sam's AI and figure out the best time and off it should go.
Is that Sam Altman you're thinking of there?
Yeah, maybe. Exactly right. It might be a little bit busy. That's what we want. We want to interact with computers like we interact with great assistants who then help us do our job. So our jobs become easier. I'm not sure what our jobs are. That's another question in the future, but I don't have the answer for that. And so mindset's part in that is really, really about kind of taking our strengths, which is we are able to take in great amounts of IP, large amounts of data, be that in video or audio or document form, use lots of different techniques to organize that data, lots of different databases, so graph databases and other databases, to produce a knowledge graph, which is what we open this discussing. And a knowledge graph is essentially that. It's a graph of your knowledge or of your data that shows all the interconnections between it. So it shows people connected with ideas, ideas connected with other ideas. And it's a very detailed thing. You can actually visualize it in this three-dimensional kind of graph format. And we use that as a reference when we are working with a language model. So user asks a question, we look at the knowledge graph and we decide what to send to the language model that then makes some sense of that and brings back an answer. And then we look again at the answer and we look at the knowledge graph and then we respond to the user, either having enriched it from the knowledge graph or maybe even rejected it. So decided that it's not the right answer and push back on the language model again, saying that your answer was not correct. And a lot of the new kind of working of language models is a multi-functional discussion before it even gets to the user, going backward and forward. What's great about that, so this visualization of data in a certain way. So if you think about where most people think their data is, it's probably in a SharePoint library or Dropbox or something like that. And everyone's just given up, you know, because it's there and the policy documents are there and everything's out of date. And they think, well, gosh, one day I must sort them out and go and make sure that everything's okay. I think these days you don't need to do that, actually, because the actual files or the classification means nothing anymore. What's inside them means something. So you need to, therefore, understand what's inside them and be able to visualize that and also understand what people are, how people are using that data. And we'll kind of go down to this when we talk about bias, actually, because I think that that's part of the jobs of companies like ours is to deal with that.
One of the mantras that you previously shared with me is that how people feel about what they're working on is really paramount to their success. It's a software written with passion and dedication, and people need to be respected and empowered to achieve their very best. So how do you go about measuring the passion and the dedication of your teams, especially in this era of remote and hybrid working?
It's one I've played with over the decades, to be honest. I've learned to my cost that if you choose the wrong metric, you get the wrong behavior. So, well, if you choose a metric, you're going to get a certain behavior and it may not be the behavior you were expecting. Let me put it that way. So I think right now, there's many a metric that many people use that I don't think is important, actually. So people, for example, look at, if I just talk about developers, they look at estimation of time and then how accurate the developer was in terms of actually delivering within the time frame that they said they were going to. As a developer myself, I know that that's just a complete fallacy, because if you want me to be accurate, I'm going to give you really large estimates to make sure that I've padded them out sufficiently to make sure that I deliver everything well in time. Simple. I solve a problem that way. If I'm going to give you what I think is the estimate in the beginning, I probably would have had to spend too much time getting to that estimate in the first place to be really sure of it. So you're working in this world of kind of variable gravity. So why try and find some certainty about that? So what I try to measure in terms of passion is quality as a value. So if you look at someone's attention to detail in a piece of work, and what I often say to people is, when you deliver something, I'm going to assume it's your best. I'm going to assume that's the very best that you can deliver within the time you've got and you've made the right decisions. And I keep that up, and I put the same passion into my own delivery. You know, I'll stay up all night if I need to get something exactly right. And I won't let it be not exactly right. And it may still not be wrong or whatever, but I'll put everything into it because I will not put something forward that I'm not proud about. So, you know, you need to look for that. And you see this played out, actually. I contribute a great deal to open source, and I work in one of the big communities. And people are incredibly passionate about what they do. They give up their weekends and their time for no money. So it's a true expression of passion. And one of the real things there is pride of work, you know, recognition. One of the things you get rewarded with for what you do, people recognize you as your best work. So I often think, like, how do you take that into a company? You know, which then means you've got to look at people's motivational systems. There's a fantastic author you may know called Daniel Pink, who wrote a book called The Surprising Truth About What Motivates People, Drive, again, which is an incredibly insightful book. So I think that there is no one measure of this. I think you have to understand people and what their specific motivators are. And if you generalize that, I'd generalize it down to being passionate and being proud of what they do.
And one of the things that impressed and yet at the same time intrigued me is that although you're a CEO, you still code regularly. In fact, you previously mentioned to me that you have this regime where you code every day, but from 4 a.m. to 8 a.m. So why have you decided to continue coding? And what's the thinking behind this 4 a.m. to 8 a.m. window for coding?
It's an agreement with our investors that I won't spend my time as a CEO doing coding. I said, all right, that's fine. I won't do any coding after 8 a.m., which I don't. So 8 a.m. is my cutoff day. So that excludes now weekends and early mornings. So why it's important to me? It's important to me for my mental health, to be 100% honest. So I find I'm a much better person if I understand precisely what our product is doing, and I can add my own creativity to that. There's different types of developers. So there's really professional developers who do things the right way and do them really well and really beautifully. I'm not one of those developers. I'm the type of developer that just hacks something into existence as quickly as I can to get to the results I'm looking for, to try something. And then luckily, there are other fantastic professional developers who will then turn that into something that is releasable. For me, it's a creative expression. And I'd rather, my form of creative expression is to write in code versus write in specification. So I don't get any personal joy from writing a specification document or sending someone an email saying, I think it'd be a great idea if we did the following. I get a lot of personal joy from doing it myself. So it's an indulgence. I go to sleep at night with an idea that's burning in my head that has to be solved the next morning. And Hoppus 4 is quite late. If I get up at Hoppus 4, it can often be 2 or something. I'll really focus in on it. And it's one of those things that I have flow state with. So very, very quickly, 6 hours has gone without any break or any notice that time has disappeared between those two things. And I think I don't find anything else in my life like that, that occupies my whole brain in that way. So as I said, it's an indulgence. It is an indulgence. I know I bring value. So I bring value to what we do because I change stuff, and I generally change it for the better. And I know I've brought a lot of value to different open source projects. So when the team becomes too big and our own product becomes too complicated, I will move back into open source and no longer be working on our own code base. But at the moment, we're small enough for that still to be the case.
What does the future hold for coding? Will humans still be doing their own coding in 10, 12 years' time?
That's a question I think about a great deal, and I don't think so. I don't think so. It's just so inefficient. And even now, I mean, my own use of ChatGPT and coding, I must use it 100 times a day easily. So, and I think every developer is or should be at the moment. So you write a bit of code and you paste into ChatGPT of a comment saying, please improve this, you know, or make this better or change it in this way, or write the unit test for me, you know, whatever it might be. So all of the things that were kind of really annoying or that you'd have to spend ages searching Google for, you can now ask because it's all been indexed. And you can cut and paste code that is probably better than what you're able to produce. And we're only where we are now. This technology has only been out for a year. So go forward 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 4 years. People are not going to be working in that way. Same as many professions, you know, the legal profession, accounting, many professions that were human domain before. So actually, and it's a funny thing, I see code as poetry in a way right now. It's the end of its days. You know, and it's an indulgence again. So we'll still, I think, for some time, need people to find a way to describe what they're looking for to a computer system. And some form of coding might be a good way of doing that. I question the following. So certainly if we're in our own company using generative AI in our own coding, we're actually doing more coding than we were doing before. So we're producing more product and more functionality than we were last year. So it's allowed us to go faster. It hasn't reduced the number of people we need or the amount of work that we've got. And I think we are producing better quality code as a result of that. So I wonder at which point that changes, where you actually need a fewer people to accomplish something. I don't know about that. I think that human aspiration just continues to grow and our own aspiration will continue to grow. And there's still not enough hours in the day to get what we want done. I wonder if that dynamic will change.
And what's the biggest mistake and the biggest learning from your entrepreneurial career thus far?
The biggest mistake, age 24, we were offered £60 million for our business and we turned it down because we thought it wasn't nearly enough money. that was the biggest mistake I ever made. Biggest learning, it's tough. It's really tough. So people who create companies and take all the risks and join companies early on and make things work, you know, that zero to one from nothing to something is incredibly tough. And you don't ever remember how tough it is. So each time you go back, you think, I've got this new startup burning in me. I know it'll be easy. I've learned so much. I know so much. I know so many people. Mm-mm. It's really, really tough. So making a product successful, unless you're just incredibly lucky, maybe, is always really hard work, I'd say, is the learning. And I still learn that on a daily basis.
And what was the learning from that 60 million rejection, that offer you turned down?
If someone offers you a big check, take it. I think it's probably as simple as that. No, I mean, at the time, we were 100% owners of the business. We hadn't raised much money. We're doing incredibly well. We'd stumbled into product market fit. I wouldn't say we just were incredibly lucky. Things were growing like mad. The internet was just taking off. There was tons of money sloshing around. You know, we were in the right place, right time, right investor. And we had all the enthusiasm and arrogance of youth to allow us to turn it down. And, you know, we were so dismissive of it. We were like, what do you mean? You know, American companies are selling for billions. How dare you offer us just 60 million? Anyway, I wish I could go back and tap younger self on the shoulder and say, maybe say yes.
I bet. Well, Barry, thank you so much for sharing your journey and your vision with me on today's episode of the Startup to Scale Up Game Plan.
It's a pleasure and been lovely to speak to you.
This episode of the Startup to Scale Up Game Plan was brought to you by Alpina Search. Head over to www.alpinasearch.com for advice on scaling your technology startup and recruiting high-impact senior talent.